Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Vivian Stockman. She's project coordinator for the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, which is based in Huntington, West Virginia. Stockman's photos of mountaintop removal and the movement to stop this extreme coal mining practice have been published in newspapers, magazines, books, and documentaries and on websites. Publications include the New York Times, The Washington Monthly, Orion Magazine, World Watch Magazine, E! Magazine, French Geo, and dozens more. She's assisted with, consulted for, and been filmed for several documentaries, including Time to Choose, The Last Mountain, Burning the Future, Goodbye Golly Mountain, and others. So first, thank you for your very important work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, I'll just say thank you for having me, and thanks, too, for all your work.
Thank you.
It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. So what does MTR stand for, and what actually is mountaintop removal?
So mountaintop removal is MTR, as we abbreviate it around here because we're sadly used to dealing with it. But it's an extreme form of coal mining in which mountaintops are actually blown up. So, you know, that doesn't sound, well, that might not be too bad, but to go into some detail about that, where this is going on is in the central Appalachians. I'm based in West Virginia. It's also going on in parts of Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. And our area, our neck of the woods, is actually some pretty amazing woods. We have some of the most biologically diverse temperate hardwood forests on Earth. And right where I'm sitting, you know, looking out my window here, there's probably 60 to 80, well, not right here, but overall in our region, there's about 60 to 80 different species of trees and a vast array of understory plants. And so this is, you know, a really crucial area for biodiversity and ecological stability. And this area has been called the Mother Forest because down here, you know, we weren't glaciated. But anyway, these are some of the most amazing woods that you'll find. And underlying these woods is coal. And of course, a lot of people know the traditional method of coal mining, which is deep mining, where you dig a pit into the earth and take out the coal. And that has a whole series of problems of its own. But mountaintop removal is a whole entire other ball game, and it's pretty much what it sounds like. You blast the tops off the mountains. So once a coal company determines there's a coal seam underneath some land that they want to get, they go about getting it. And why they can get it is a lot of West Virginia land is owned by land companies, sort of all goes all the way back to the railroads and then buying up this area. So the people will live in the hollers, and the hills are not owned by the people, but have been used for centuries as sort of the commons. But all of a sudden, the coal company has decided that, you know, the best way to get the remaining coal is to, rather than go into the mountain, take the top of the mountain off, blast it right off. So they'll start the process of mountaintop removal by raising the forest. And usually they're in such a hurry that they don't even bother to harvest the trees for any sort of other use, but they just push them over the edge and burn them, the edge of the mountain. So these mountaintop removal operations are not small. They can be seen from outer space. They're massive. One particular mine nearby is about the size of Manhattan and ever-growing. So once the trees are gone, the bulldozers come in and start scraping away the soil. The soil is not saved. The soil is pushed over the mountain edge into the valley. And then once they get to the rock, they start laying charges, blasts, and blasting away the rock to get to the layers of coal beneath the rocks. So you're talking about blasts that can be anywhere from 10 to 100 times the force of the blast that leveled that took apart the Oklahoma building, the Timothy McVeigh bombing. And in fact, the same sort of material is used for the explosive. So you're having blasts going off. The blasts pulverize the sandstone and the shale layers, and the coal is eventually exposed. Now, there's a whole set of problems associated with the blasting, because as you can imagine, when you're blasting sandstone, what you're creating is silica. And so this silica is raining down over the workers and over the communities below where this type of mining is going on, and that causes huge health problems. And all sorts of studies have gone on that show that people living near mountaintop removal operations have much shorter lifespans and a whole host of illnesses associated with living near these mines. So as the mountains are blasted away, the coal is gathered and it's moved off, sent to market for power plants or sometimes metallurgical coal, and the process just keeps going. They can take about 800 feet off a mountain, anywhere from 400 to 800 feet. So you're completely annihilating some of these incredible forests. And that's not, of course, the only thing that's happening. You're also annihilating the headwater streams. And just like our forests around here are so biodiverse, our streams are incredibly diverse, too. We have great aquatic diversity. And crucial to that are our headwater streams. And because the headwater streams are sort of where, in these upper reaches of the mountains, where if twigs and branches and leaves fall into the stream in these headwater reaches, there's a lot of critters that live that break down those the leaves and the twigs into fats and other nutrients that are used downstream. And so it's kind of crucial to have these headwater streams, but we're blasting them away or burying them under the former mountaintops, because what happens is all they're creating all this rubble from mountaintop removal. The all that debris, you know, you're talking just massive amounts of debris, is pushed into valleys and creates these constructions called valley fills. And the valley fills bury the headwater streams, and communities used to be in these valleys a lot of times. So mountaintop removal coal mining is not only annihilating the mountains and the waters, it's also driving communities away, because, you know, well, if your holler where you live is going to be buried, you got to get out of there. And a whole host of problems associated with mountaintop removal coming into your neighborhood. I don't know if I've clearly explained it there.
You have very, very clearly, and you've, as we're talking, I'm looking at the website for OHVEC.org your website for the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition.
Right, that's the group I work for.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website, and I would recommend that anybody who's listening to this also look at it, because they're just these horrific pictures of basically devastation as far as you can see. It's
right.
They've turned West Virginia into
it's like Mars or a moonscape. It's it's alien to what was here. And it's an experimental. I don't know what kind of experiment it is. It's an insane experiment. So, but, you know, we're creating new ecosystems that don't really work.
So you've said that one of them is the size of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what is the scale of this in the entire region? Do you know?
Years and years ago, a whole bunch of groups together, working with some fabulous lawyers, sued to get a programmatic environmental impact statement done. If you can even believe it, this scale of destruction there, you know, was going on, being permitted without any sort of environmental impact statement, any studies as to what the hell the coal companies were doing when they're annihilating the ecosystem like this. So And then, you know, that took years to come out. There was a bunch of wrangling around it. And one thing with it all was, you know, the data is really hard to come by because the companies get permits sort of piecemeal, you know, 200 acres here, right adjacent 170 acres, so forth and so on. So they get these piecemeal permits, and it's, you know, and it's different agencies that they have to get different permits through. So tracking exactly what is going on has been a bit hard, but, you know, it's something the draft environmental impact statement said basically about 1 million acres either already mined or permitted. And even though this is years old, this is still some of our best, best information. And, you know, and even there's lots of different mountains have been gone. Some of them haven't been named. So people have been trying to figure out exactly how many mountains are gone. And, you know, best guesses on that are about 500. Some of the, like NASA has some photographs of the Hobet, H-O-B-E-T, mine over time, and you can just see it growing, and you can see how much acreage there is. And then, so there's been some work with that type of trying to figure out how much has gone by looking at satellite images and all that. But so roughly 1 million acres, but, you know, the data is a little bit lacking. And
so so they kill the forest, and they kill the mountain, and they kill the streams, and then I grew up in Colorado, and I remember going up in the mountains all the time and seeing leftover mines, you know, the tailings piles from 120 years previous. And or 100 years previous, and there's still nothing growing on them. I mean, you know that I think this is a huge atrocity. I want to talk about, you know, the death urge of this culture in a minute, but before then, what happens when they try to rehabilitate? Is there, obviously the original forest is dead, so whatever comes back is not the same forest, but are the rehabilitations successful even in the slightest?
In my opinion, no. Of course, if you worked for the industry, you might say yes. But, you know, that was another figure that came out of the draft environmental impact statement, was that it would take 500 years for the forest to return. You know, I mean, this kind of mining activity makes clear cutting out west look nice because, you know, that's an insane statement. Yeah, you still have the soil. You still have the seed bank. You know, you still have well, I don't know how much of a chance, but here, you know, basically you're scraped it down to rock and rubble. And then, you know, so one of the things, there's these laws about reclamation. Of course, there's all sorts of laws around mountaintop removal, and they're all routinely ignored. I mean, and if coal companies, like, actually followed the law about mountaintop removal, I don't think they could actually do it. But back to reclamation, back in the 60s, there was a whole movement against strip mining, which strip mining was so much more less large and destructive than mountaintop removal. But even back then, there was author Harry Caudill wrote Night Comes Through the Cumberlands, and he was the first one, I think, that said, you know, reclamation is akin to lipstick on a corpse. And so you're talking about, you know, so this once rich, lush forest has been reduced to these, you know, scrub species. A lot, you can go in that Hobet site, for instance, and you can see, you know, there's grass on the hills and there's some gray-green shrubs growing and some which turn out to be autumn olive, which, you know, of course, most states won't even let anybody plant because it's so invasive. And there's you know, so if you don't know what you're looking at and you don't know what you've lost, you're like, oh, that looks okay. But, you know, it's just completely alien landscape to what we had. And the state has, you know, all these great promotions about, say, you know, what you can do on mountaintop removal land, because West Virginia doesn't have enough flat land for quote-unquote development. So, You know, there's this one place in Mingo County where they have taken a vast mountaintop removal site and stuck a lot of taxpayers, not a lot, a few, a handful of taxpayer subsidized development type dealios, such as a wood products place. And so on, you can drive onto this sort of vast mesa that makes you feel like you're in like Africa or something. You just left Appalachia and you're on some African plain. And so way over there, there's a little bit of a, you know, where they have the wood products thing. And there's another little, you know, place that's supposed to bring jobs and advance West Virginia over here. But this is just one site, and there's just like huge amounts of open area where, you know, nothing's going to come of that. And so the idea with reclamation from the state and the coal companies is, oh, these are great places for future economic development. But there's one huge problem. Even if people did want to come to this treeless, sun-baked plateau that has nothing to do with West Virginia, you know, the problem being the water. So the naturally, when you're churning up the landscape and breaking up the rock and coal on this massive level, you know, all that formerly sequestered rock, yeah, minerals in the rock and heavy metals in the rock and coal are, you know, suddenly exposed to air and water and begin leaching into the waterways. So, you know, selenium is one of the huge problems with these sites, even once they're quote unquote reclaimed. The water, you know, is just problematic in perpetuity. So the idea that anybody's going to want to come and do a bunch of economic development on this devastated area without water, you know, I don't know what the state's thinking. I mean, I do know what the politicians are thinking. They're thinking where their next campaign contribution from the coal industry is coming, you know, when that's coming in. So the state has just been so long wedded to the coal industry. The politicians have been, you know, it's almost a revolving door between the, we've had governors with really deep ties to the coal industry, and just basically allowed this sort of outlaw, greedy industry to have its way with the state.
Okay, I want to come back to that in a second, but I want to go back to the mountains, because this, honestly, you know, I've done some interviews about some horrifying topics, and this is one of the most horrifying, I think. This, aren't these some of the oldest mountains on the planet?
Yeah, they're that's some of the speculation is, yes, these are some of the oldest mountains on Earth. And you know, that these used to be really, really high, and now they're eroded down. And you know, we've got peaks in the coal field areas around 2,000 feet or so. So you know, they're not like your mountains out west, but these are old mountains with a lot of, you know, both biological and cultural history.
And I mean that they're. I am kind of speechless at the notion of destroying, of killing a mountain that is, who is, older than the Rockies, you know, and older than the Alps. I mean, these mountains are incredibly ancient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And like you said, there, can you talk for a moment about what you said about the mother forest and the lack of glaciation?
Well, that's so, because this area wasn't glaciated, so, you know, the glaciation would have scraped away the soil and scraped away the seeds. So this is just, the seeds here are the, you know, the mother for forests elsewhere. I mean, as plants can migrate, animals can help them migrate. And, you know, so this is just considered the mother forest for our region. So, yeah, and you think about, you know, what they're doing to this mother forest.
So so now let's go back to the politicians. And I mean, there's this long history, like you said, of politicians basically, the government basically overrunning people to destroy the land. And mm-hmm. If we forget the politicians and we forget the really rich people, what do local human beings, for the most part, think about the mountaintop removal? Are they grateful for jobs and happy? Are they anti-environmental jerks like sometimes you find in some places? Or are they unhappy because their life is being destroyed? What's the mix?
Well, sadly, in areas where coal is mined, that's like the industry. That's the job that people have. So, we count among our members several deep miners. I don't know how many, but, deep miners. And I know from extensive conversations with people who have been deep miners that, they understand that mountaintop removal is just insane and wrong. And I've also had conversations with people who are actually in the industry who would much rather have something else to do but don't have anything else to do. And then there's people that, will say, I don't care. The coal industry's has been, I heard one of the lobbyists say that the mountains are worthless pieces of dirt. And I mean, there's definitely people who don't understand their relationship to the earth, the need the earth to live. And, I've been at hearings about permits or, where if somebody brings up the human health impacts associated with this and how devastating they are, people have actually said, I don't care if I get cancer later, I need a job now. And so that well-perpetrated myth of jobs versus the environment is alive and well here. And the there's been so little attempt at diversifying the economy. That I feel like the dynamic is shifting. Yesterday there was a big day of prayer about the coal industry, put on by a rabid coal industry supporter, and he had all these churches trying to do the same sort of prayer about bring back the coal miner. But there were also people who were muttering about, maybe the prayers of the oppressed have been heard, and that's why the coal industry is dying. So I think what's happening now is people are realizing that though coal has often gone through a cycle of boom and bust, that this one's looking really bust. And they're pissed at the politicians for not having helped diversify the economy. And at the same time, there's all these little pockets of sort of, okay, this is what we can do arising, where people are trying local, local foods and trying to promote solar co-ops. And, there's things that people are doing on their own to bring about change, but the government is fighting them at every turn. So I think I drifted off our original question.
No, that's great. That's okay. Great. And so, so I'm going to ask a question now just because I'm curious, and this is a little bit dangerous because being an interviewer is kind of like an attorney. You're never supposed to ask a question to which you don't already sort of have an idea of the answer, but this I have no idea. But I've been studying U.S. coal production lately, and I hear a lot in the newspapers, you just said, about the decline of the coal industry, but U.S. coal extraction is still within about 10 or 15% of what it's been for the last 25 years. It's sort of hanging fairly constant, and the coal's being exported, a lot of it.
Right.
So can you explain to me how the coal industry is, quote, dying, but coal extraction remains fairly constant? Is this because of automation? What am I missing? And I actually don't know the answer to this at all.
Okay, well, around here, so out west is the production is sort of shifting more out west, but I think the same thing is happening out there. And now our major our major coal companies are going bankrupt, but there's still smaller ones going on. But, you know, in terms of why the coal industry feels like it's dying, is that because the percentage of electricity produced from coal is dropping with the rise of, you know, our friends, the great fracking, the fracked up fracking. So, you know, as unnatural gas, as methane takes over at power plants, that's causing a lot of pressure on the coal industry. And even, you know, China's exports are supposed to be dropping. I think India is the only one still rising. I could be wrong on that, but so it's the share of electricity that coal has. Now, the other use for coal is metallurgical coal, which is used in steel making. And so, you know, that's a different beast, but the companies are going belly up.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm still a little confused, because the extraction, like I said, extraction numbers have remained relatively constant. They've gone down a little bit, but they're within 10 or 15% of what they were even 25 years ago, but it's being exported. I mean, there's still a lot. So how are the coal mining, why are the coal mining companies going? I understand what you said about losing a share, but they're also exporting more. The exports have actually gone up.
Well, that's probably all metallurgical coal.
Oh.
That is definitely mined here. But coal production, I'm pretty sure, has been going downward in West Virginia. So
the next question is, you know, I've lived in the West my whole life, and, you know, I've fought the whole jobs versus owls thing, and I fought that in the timber industry a lot. And one of the things that always made me mad was that they would say it's jobs versus owls. What they would never mention is that all through the 80s and 90s, with a cut going up, jobs were going down because of raw log exports and automation. And that's kind
right.
of what I brought that up about the exports, is about the coal exports, how, you know, my primary concern is always for biodiversity. That's what I care about most. So putting, you know, jobs and everything else in a perspective of less important than the real world, but still, what's the relationship between automation/exports, either one? Here's what I'm trying to say. What's the relationship between coal extraction volume and jobs over the last 20, 30 years, especially with mountaintop removal?
Well, you know, a drag line, those massive types of machines that are used on mountaintop removal sites replace so many men. And, you know, yeah, that's why the jobs argument from the industry lobbyists themselves is really, you know, it's just really hard to take, because the industry is notorious for not really giving a crap about the workers. And, you know, they're fighting workers, deep miners, black lung protection right now, and always they're fighting that. And so you look as these mountaintop removal production, as mountaintop removal rose, production skyrocketed and jobs plummeted. You know, you look at the graph of the two, the production's going up, and, you know, it's an X, and the jobs are just going downhill. And I mean, that's been a steady decline for probably 40 years. So yeah, the automation and the scale of these plants and of these sites and the machines that they use on them has just, you know, and I think some of the deep miners really, you know, say there, you can see a bumper sticker around here that says, real miners do it deep and in the dark, something like that, because, you know, they don't feel like people driving giant bulldozers on these sites are necessarily coal miners. They might be coal workers, but they're not the traditional miners. So yeah, the jobs plummet, production rises, and
environmentalists get blamed.
Right. And, you know, and also community members, excuse me, get pitted against one another. You know, I mean, that's something the coal industry has been fabulous at doing, is making people, just like, you know, certain politicians and, you know, people move against their own self-interest and pitting neighbor against neighbor and this type of thing. So, you know, I've had people who have contacted us who weren't so up in arms about mountaintop removal and came until it came into their neighborhood. And then, you know, so, and the other aspect of the mountaintop of the coal industry itself is sort of the bullying, thuggy nature of it. You know, if you, people want to say something, but they can't say something because, you know, their husband or their cousin or their daughter or somebody works for the industry and is going to get in trouble if they come out speaking against it. So, you know, that's another way they use to sort of pit people against one another and keep things under control.
So what is it like to live? There's a picture on your website I can't see the picture right now, but it's Anita somebody's home.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then there's the mountaintop removal going on, mm-hmm. not too far. There's a little bit of forest in between, and then the mountaintop removal. What is it like to live with mountaintop removal going on? You've mentioned blast and you've mentioned silica dust, but what is it like to actually live with that happening?
Well, why don't I just tell the story about Anita's home there as sort of a representative example. You know, that little house there, you can see that's a one-story ranch. Anita's father and a friend built it. You know, they found this beautiful place in West Virginia, and it was near, right down the road, is the old home place where the father grew up, and was right near the hollow where he used to, there was a whole community up there, and he taught up there. So he built this house for his family thinking they'd live there the rest of their lives. And that hollow where he used to teach school, well, that became one of the first valley fills in West Virginia. And that valley fill is probably about 9 miles long. You know, that whole community that was up there is gone. And this is all around the community of Mud in Lincoln County, West Virginia. And that community does not exist anymore. It's just representative of, you know, one area, and so many communities have been driven to extinction. So this family was one of the last to sell out. You know, the coal company comes in and says, you know, hey, we're gonna be mining over here, and we'll buy off your property for you. And, you know, a lot of people hold out, or a lot of people see the writing on the wall, and it's like you've got to take their offer because as the mountaintop removal gets closer, your property values just plummet. So this family didn't want to move. They loved where they were, but then the blasting was getting closer. You know, they would be sitting at dinner, and a blast would go off, and the family pictures on the wall would rattle. And then there was the problem of their well water, which so many people in West Virginia rely on well water for their water needs at home, for cooking, bathing, drinking. So, you know, all of a sudden their well water went bad because presumably one of the blasts changed the, you know, rocked the underground structure, and the water just became just bad. It used to be good, became bad. And, you know, these type of blasts, the company will give you a warning signal that they're about to happen. But even when, you know, so you're prepped for it, you know it's coming. But even when that happens, you know, you still have this parasympathetic response. And, you know, it's nerve-wracking as hell. People start exhibiting signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, people were complaining about health problems from the dust and all this long before any of this studies ever solidified what is just common sense. So there's the pain of losing your home place, you know, can you imagine, you know, your family has lived here for generations, and you're part of a group of people that are really forest dwellers that make a culture of living off the land, of, you know, so you can go up in the mountains and you can get ginseng for the medicine cabinet. You can, you can go up there with grandma and she can teach you, you know, well, that's a hickory tree. You can take the bark of that and we can cane a chair. You know, you can make furniture from the woods. You can have your pharmacy from the woods. You can fill your larder from the woods. You know, you can harvest the venison and you can, kill the deer and harvest the venison. Or get the wild grapes, or just all these ways that you live off the land. And Anita's father, you know, up the road from where he built his house, there were 10 kids, and many of the kids had said they were poor, but they didn't know it because the land, you know, was everything. And so, you know, that is crumbling before your very eyes, that culture. And, you know, since the time that we started working on this issue, I think the term solastalgia has come up, you know. And so just the heartache of having your land destroyed, that I guess far too many people around the world know. And then, you know, sort of the political disenchantment that comes with it too, to realize how corrupt the politics are and how, you know, this might not really be a democracy. And, you know, there's just so many things associated with what happens when a mountaintop removal mine rolls into the neighborhood.
So what are you, tell me about your work and tell me about the work of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. What are you doing?
Well, can I give you a little history of how we got into this?
Please.
Okay, well, OVAC is a little group based in Huntington, West Virginia. We started in 1987 when BASF Corporation was going to bring in all of its waste from North America and either bury it or burn it in a low-income community near Huntington. And, you know, people got up in arms about this, and, you know, it all started as a living room group where people organized and basically worked on that issue for about 7 years until it didn't happen. And then over the years, OVEC has taken on assorted issues. I got involved with the group in 1995 when one of my friends called me to a meeting and said, hey, you got to come find out about this. There's a proposal to build a pulp mill about 40 miles from here, and it would eat about 10,000 trees a day and belch dioxin into the atmosphere. And so she wasn't at that time, but the woman who's now our executive director, Janet Keating, and another organizer came to speak to us. And, you know, I was just flabbergasted that my little piece of almost heaven, West Virginia, could become fodder for a stinky, poisonous, stupid idea of a pulp mill that, you know, the governor was going to give $1 million per job in tax breaks. You know, it's like, why don't you give $1 million to each of the people that might get a job and let them do some entrepreneurial work or something?
Exactly.
Something. Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, so that's I got involved.
How about give them $500,000 each to help reforest?
Right. I know the idea. You know, common sense. You know, that's a whole other thing we didn't do, but yeah, doesn't fly well in the face of corporate greed. Anyway, so I got involved with OVEC on that issue, and I volunteered for quite some time, and I guess I worked so hard on it that they finally found some money to hire me part-time and then eventually full-time. And about the time that we were, you know, that the pulp mill issue was winding down, it never did get built. Some people came to us about that time. It was in the late, mid-90s, I guess, maybe 90. Seven or so, I'm not sure, 96, 97, people came to us and said, hey, have you heard about mountaintop removal? And we're like, no, what's that? And so they started telling us. And these were people who had been to their local politicians, they'd been to the coal companies themselves, they'd been to the state level politicians, and they'd been to, you know, trying to get in touch with the federal level politicians, and, you know, and then and working with our Department of Environmental Protection, or they'd been to all these, you know, quote unquote officials, and hadn't gotten any traction on mountaintop removal. And as far as I know, that at that time, the only environmental group that had sort of had it on its radar screen was the state's oldest environmental group, the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, because I know Cindy Rank, who's their mining chair, she had gone up Conley Branch, which is that hollow I told you where the father was a school teacher. She had been up there before it was buried, and, you know, sort of knew that it was coming. But so anyway, the folks told us about mountaintop removal, and we decided we needed to educate ourselves about it and start educating the public too. So we held the first ever forum on mountaintop removal, and we had a representative from Arch Coal and one of the persons who was impacted, you know, living near a mine, and maybe somebody from DEP or anything. And so, you know, that was the start of us getting involved in the issue and trying to educate ourselves and, you know, the public far and wide about this. You know, and even from the very first time we were learning about it, we're like, cannot believe this has been going on under our noses, and cannot believe that it is even going on, and, you know, and cannot believe that we have to stand up here and argue that it's wrong. You know, it's like, why would this even be allowed? So you know, we have organizers on the ground working on it. We have, you know, public education, I think, is one of our big aspects, and then legal work is another big aspect. And I think from when we started working on it, you know, there's really been a movement, you know, more groups coming in, new groups formed, all sorts of coalitions, and a lot of attorneys helping to, you know, either through education, through political lobbying, through organizing, and through lawsuits, attempting to, you know, slay this monster.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and a couple questions I want to ask is, well, after I ask the next question, I want to ask, how can people help and what do you want people to do? But before then, I know the crystal ball is always cloudy, but sort of predict the short to medium term future for the mountains of West Virginia concerning mountaintop removal. Do you see things getting worse? Do you think you see them getting better? What do you see as the future?
You know, well, coal companies, one of them has been going around saying it's not doing mountaintop removal anymore. It's, but it's just a case of linguistic detoxification. You know, they've decided it's something else. But, you know, a lot of the work going on now is about addressing the quote-unquote legacy costs, you know, this long-term pollution, the barren land, and then just looking at transition, you know, what can we do to get out of this carbon era, and you know, there was a, you know, what can we do to heal what's already been just so horribly wounded. One of the groups that we're a member group of is the Alliance for Appalachia, or of Appalachia, and you know, transition work and just looking at ways that we can, you know, diversify our economy and stop poisoning any more land and water and people. That's the next phase.
So let's say that somebody lives in Nova Scotia or Florida or West Virginia. I guess those are separate things. What can they do to help your struggle?
Well, you know, it depends on the level of commitment. When you said Florida, Gainesville loves mountains comes to mind. You know, people there decided that they would go to their, they have a particular structure in their public utility, and they went to the local officials there and got a resolution passed that their utility would no longer buy any coal from mountaintop removal mine coal. So, you know, that took a lot of local level organizing, but that was this, you know, intense partnership from people from far away who could care. You know, of course, people can always write letters to the editor. Of course, I'm going to say, please join OVEC. We have power in numbers, and we really need members to. And then, you know, you can get on our action alert list. You could just Google mountaintop removal and look at all the different groups working on it. And if you don't like ours, find one that you do like and join them and help out. There's all, you know, action alerts from our group, from other groups about upcoming actions. And, you know, and of course, you know, wean yourself off coal. Go solar if you can. And I mean, that's the beauty of a lot of what's going on here is people are sick up and fed, you know, with the politicians, and they're, you know, moving forward without them.
So I guess the last question is, help choose one or two plants or animals or fungi or places, it doesn't matter, and with like 1 minute, help people across the country who are harmed by mountaintop removal and help people to fall in love with them, like a species of newt or a species of frog or trout or somebody. Is there somebody you especially love who is harmed by this that you just want to give a shout out to?
Ruffed grouse. I have somewhere on that website, or I'll try to get it prominent up here before this airs, is I came across a ruffed grouse and shot a picture of it. You know, this poor creature was at the bottom. It was in a stream, near a stream, in a valley, and on both sides of it, mountaintop removal was getting closer and closer. And this magnificently beautiful bird, its habitat is just gone. And, you know, the pecarel frog is jumping through the stream, and, you know, it's about to just be buried under millions of tons of former mountains. You know, I mean, these are just the, you know, the innocent species that, you know, when I've walked at the edge of some of these sites where the trees are already failed, and you see, you know, a wren hopping on the fallen log, because, you know, its nest is on the branch and on the ground that's buried in the ground now as the tree fell. You know, these are the critters that, like it or not, you know, we are, you know, we need them to survive, and we're killing them.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Vivian Stockman. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.